Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on conflict, why escalation is reasonable. So let's listen in on Chuck Huff.
I'm a social psychologist, which means I study how people get along with each other. And how things like perception and cognition influence how people interact with each other, how people think about each other. What I can promise you today is the opportunity to think more complexly about some issues regarding social conflict. I cannot promise you answers. That is, I can't give you tricks that will make them give you what you want. I would be making lots more money than I am now if I could do that. To play a little game with you. It's really a very straightforward game. I'd like to auction off $1. If you've heard of this, please don't tell anybody else. I'd like to auction off $1, and there are two rules in this auction. The first rule is that the person who bids the highest pays and gets the dollar. Okay? So the highest bidder, a G-H-E-S-T, it's a B, gets the dollar. The second rule is that the second highest bidder has to pay two. All right? If that's clear,
the moral of the story is be the auctioneer.
Who do we pay the money to?
Well, I think we'll probably, we'll work that out after the auction is over. This is not a new dollar, as far as I can tell, but it was signed by Nicholas Brady, so that makes it a little older. But it does still work. We can start with bids of a nickel.
6 cents.
8 cents.
25 cents.
For 25 cents. Do I hear anything more than 25 cents?
30
cents. 30 cents. Do I hear anything more?
35.
35 cents. All right. It's a cheap dollar.
40
for 35, 40 cents. 40 cents for this dollar.
50 cents.
Still a cheap dollar, 50 cents. All right, it's still a pretty cheap dollar. We're up to 60. All right, 60 cents for this dollar. Do I hear anything over 60 cents? You can still get this dollar for pretty cheap. Actually, make money.
$0.65.
All right.
70 cents.
70 cents? 70 cents. Okay. 75 cents will get you a dollar.
75.
80 cents. 80 cents. 85 cents will get you a dollar. You're still making 15.
This can go up with no limit.
85 cents. 90 cents. 86 cents?
90.
90 cents for this dollar. All right. 95 cents for this dollar. Anybody? 96 cents? So you have a bid of 95 cents and a bid of 90 cents for this dollar, right?
96.
96. All right. Well, if I made that salient, I get another bid.
97.
97 cents. Do we have another bid? said, you can still get this dollar for less than it's worth. Going once.
A dollar.
A dollar. All right. Do I hear a dollar and 1 cent for this?
One.
All right. There we go.
This could go up to 50 bucks.
Dollar what? 50 bucks? Did I hear that? So we've got a dollar and a dollar one. Do I hear another? But dollar two will get you this dollar. And there's not very many people interested in bidding in it, except perhaps
one person.
One person. Going once?
I'll do it.
Dollar two?
Mm-hmm.
All right, dollar two.
I'll go dollar three.
Dollar three! Here we go.
Now raise the minimum increments. Make it 25 cent increments to watch what happens.
Dollar three. You're going to stop? All right. So you get this for dollar three. You have to pay me $1.02. And whatever money I make on it, I'll give to Holden Village. All right. This is an example of escalation. I have sold a dollar for more than $2.50 in my classes. You can make lots of money this way. Once. Because once they figure it out, they're not going to play again. Actually, there's a whole lot of dynamics that are going on in that game. In the first part of the game, the feel of the game was very different than it was as we got towards the end, and there were just two bidders. I want to talk some about the dynamics of that kind of escalation in terms of the kind of transformations that occur when we're in a sequence of escalation and a conflict. But the first thing I want to do is to talk about why it might be reasonable to escalate and some strategies that you can use in escalation. Here's where the overhead comes in. There isn't anything inherently destructive about using contentious tactics with someone else. Now that's hard to believe, but I want to try to convince you of that with a couple of diagrams that I used earlier this week. And that is making a move from thinking of conflict as a thing where you win and I have to lose to a thing where it's possible for both of us to win. What we usually think about, oh boy, is that crooked. What we usually think about when we think about conflict is that each party is only concerned for their own benefit. And that's this upper model, which is concern for us is completely on the other end of concern for them. So to the extent that you do something for them, you lose stuff for you. In fact, it's possible to take that linear model and bend it into this two-dimensional thing where you might find that there is a way to be concerned both for yourself and for the other. And earlier we talked about different kinds of strategies that might occur if you were concerned both for yourself and for the other, like problem solving. But I want to suggest today that contending, coming up with contentious tactics,
may be a thing that you can do when you're concerned both about your own outcomes and about the other person's outcomes, but they right now don't want to budge. That is, if they aren't convinced that you really care deeply about the issue, they may not be willing to budge. You can use escalation to convince them that you care deeply and try to use escalation to move the conflict into problem solving so that they will get, as we say, a wake-up call when you attempt some escalation, and they will realize that it's important for you. Now, there's some other things we have to be you have to be very clear about if you're going to use escalation for that purpose, and that is you need to be clear with the other person or the other party that you're using escalation for precisely that purpose. It's very easy to misperceive escalation. So when you escalate with the purpose of going to problem solving, you need to think carefully about issues of communication. You need to communicate to the other person that, in fact, you are concerned both for their benefit and yours, but you feel forced into escalating in order to get your benefit in addition to theirs. And you need also to communicate to them your intentions with the particular act that you're going to do, so that they know why it is you do the thing that you've done. This is tricky business, but when you are negotiating with someone who does not want to give in, sometimes this is the only way to get their attention. But I hope that by now I've convinced you that there are some circumstances under which it might be important to escalate. It can be dangerous, but if it's really, if the thing that you care about is really important to you, you could what? Give up, or you could escalate in order to try to move the other party into problem solving. So, it is not a foregone conclusion that escalation is a bad thing. It's also the case that escalation isn't simply a black or a white thing. Tactics in escalation can range from light tactics, I've got some down here, like argumentation, to very strong tactics like irrevocable commitments. So it's possible to start with light tactics and move to heavy ones as you're trying to get the other party's attention. It's not necessary immediately to bring out the big guns. Now, sometimes it feels that way, and we'll talk for a bit about why it might feel that way. I want to talk for a minute about each of these different strategies and their benefits and costs. One of the nice things about argumentation as a strategy is that it does, particularly if you are with the other person, it can really help you convince the other person that you care deeply about the issue. So if you come in to talk with them well prepared, having thought carefully both about their side and yours, and attempt to argue that the things that you need are really central to you and very important, and that you can get what you need and they can get what they need, they know that you care, that you may be willing to do something, some other kind of escalation later because you care so deeply. They know that you spent a great deal of time thinking about it, so they know that you're a person who might be good at problem solving. And in fact, if you're persuasive, they get to hear your case. So that not only do you present your case when you try to do argumentation, but you communicate a whole bunch of other things to the person with whom you are in this social conflict. One of the things that you need to think about then, if you're going to go into an argument or to argumentation with someone on the other side, is that you need to be careful, in fact, to send a clear signal. If you want to send the signal that you're a good problem solver, you might even want to say that I have done these kinds of things in the past, or I've thought very carefully about this. You might want to say, I care deeply about your outcomes, and I also care deeply about mine. Communication in these kinds of things is very, very important. One of the problems with argumentation is, in fact, that it does take a great deal of time and skill. And if you're going to try this strategy in a conflict that you're in, you might want to get other people to help you, to think with you about the strategies. Because very often, as we've talked before this week, it's possible that you might be misperceiving the situation, or you might be seeing the situation only from one angle, and you need someone's help to see it from another angle. So that when you go in with your argumentation, you have a better chance of presenting a balanced model. It is also the case in some conflicts that, in terms of the other side's perceptions or thoughts, you may be past argumentation. That is, they may have already decided that you're out to get them. And it is very easy, as we have talked before, for them to take your arguments and twist them around and say, oh, it's clear you're just trying to take advantage of it, and be slick. So it is possible for the other side to misperceive your motivations in presenting your arguments. This is why argumentation doesn't always work. Now, one of the reasons why argumentation doesn't work is that there may in fact be no solution to the problem other than one person winning and one losing. I don't want to suggest that all of our problems can be worked out. In fact, there are times when we're fighting over the kinds of stuff that one person has to win. There's a lot of problems with that, and we'll talk tomorrow about finding common ground and doing our best to avoid those kinds of situations. But it is possible, though, that when you come to somebody with a well-laid-out argument, they will have already decided that you're the enemy, and they won't be listening. I suggest, too, if you do argumentation, that you try it more than once. That is, consistency is a virtue that people look for in partners. And if you come to them more than once with an argument and an attempt to be reasonable and to persuade them, it may be that the second or the third time they will say, well, I see clearly that they do care and that they are trying to be reasonable. This also is a trap, by the way, because you can be doing it too often. That is, you can be doing argumentation on, and then in the end get hurt in a conflict. I put promises in as a kind of escalation, partly because one of the things that promises do is that they do help to convince the other party that you care deeply about the issue, which is the same thing that most of the other contentious tactics do. They help to convince the other people that you care a great deal. Another virtue of promises, of course, is that they're not contentious. They make you look like a good person rather than like somebody who issues threats. Promises also can produce mutual commitment between parties. There's a standard finding in the social research, for instance, that self-disclosure produces in the person, in the other person, a feeling of an obligation also to disclose. So that if we're having a conversation up in the cafeteria and I disclose to you something about my life, you may feel an obligation to return that. So if I give a promise, sometimes the other person will feel the obligation to promise in return. There are costs for promises. Surprise, they cost whatever you promise. So you need to be careful about being willing to give whatever it is that you promise instead of just promising something in the heat of the moment. Promises also can be seen as the other party. This is the flip side of this obligation issue that I was just talking about. Can be seen by the other party as manipulative. They can say, oh, I see what you're trying to do. So you have to be careful when you make a promise to suggest that you really are willing to give the thing and that, yes, you are to some extent being manipulative because you'd like to come to an agreement. But you're not being manipulative in order to get more than what you think you need. Promises, if you can't follow through, can be a real problem. If you promise a thing and you can't produce it, you will then be thought of in future interactions with that person as untrustworthy. And finally, in some situations, promises can produce dependence between parties. So that when I'm in a negotiation or in a conflict with someone else, it then becomes my obligation every time for me to promise something in order to get what I need. Threats are the kind of things we usually think of when we think of escalation. I think it's possible to do threats without suggesting that you don't care about the other person's benefit. Did that sentence make sense? It's possible to do threats and still care about the other person and to get the other person to think that you do. It's a trick. Part of what you have to do when you threaten something is to indicate to the other person that you feel like you are compelled to issue this threat. And sometimes you feel that way. You feel like the situation is so much like this that we will have to break off the relationship, we will have to raise our prices, we will have to do whatever it is. But I'm not doing it because I like to be in an argument. I'm doing it because the situation is compelling me to issue this. So if you continue in the way you're doing, I will have to respond in this manner. If you can pull that off, threats have a lot of virtues. They can, no surprise, convince the other person of your resolve on an issue. They know that if you're convincing, they know that it may cost them if they continue with whatever it is that they're doing. Threats also are cheap in one sense, in that if they work, you don't have to do them. You don't have to impose whatever cost it is. threats in negotiation are probably one of the most effective things. This is research for years and years, decades. One of the reasons they're effective is they get people's attention, and they make it clear that it's in the other person's attention, it's in the other person's interest to work with you. You get to play the person in the white hat if you can withdraw your threat. This is another virtue of using threats in escalation. And finally, very often in social conflicts, threats are consistent with a sense of justice that people feel. They say, if you're going to do this, then I have to do so and so, and you deserve it. No surprise, there's cost to threats. In longer-term relationships, threats can cost you. It's hard to run a long-term relationship based on threat. Some of them work, but many of them that work aren't fun, because you have to constantly be on your guard. In addition, the major danger of threat is that they can lead to counter-threat. And that is that the other person can say, oh yeah? And then you're off to the races in escalation. Another kind of strategy is the irrevocable commitment, and that is not a threat, because, in fact, you do the thing. Irrevocable, to give you an example of an irrevocable commitment, you might, in a game of chicken, when your two cars are driving at each other, throw the steering wheel out the window. Well, then it's clear you can't do anything. And one of the virtues then is that it becomes clear, if it works, it becomes clear to the other party that the ball is now in their court and they have to do something if they want to avoid the outcome. There are a whole variety of irrevocable commitments. All of them, though, depend a great deal on the context of the particular kind of relationship or conflict that you're in. Obviously, an irrevocable commitment convinces the other person of your resolve. It also makes it clear, as I said earlier, that the ball is in their court, and an irrevocable commitment can then elicit concessions from the other party. One of the real virtues of irrevocable commitments is that they do not require that the person who is making the commitment have a whole lot of power. That is, you can be the less powerful partner in a relationship or in a social conflict and make an irrevocable commitment that can often get you the things that you need.
Jeff?
Yes?
I'm having trouble visualizing that, this irrevocable commitment. The thing that comes to mind is that people in California who were against the filling of water behind a dam that they opposed on a free-running stream, and they literally tied themselves to trees in an unknown location and announced to the news media that if the water was filled behind the dam, they would drown. And
that's right.
That's
an example of an error. Gandhi's fast is another irrevocable commitment. Now, of course, whether it feels irrevocable to the other party or not depends upon their belief in your resolve. You know, will you, or are you gonna hang on? What is it that they were had tied themselves to?
Well, they chained themselves to rocks or whatever behind this dam, so that right. if water flooded, they would be drowned.
Right.
Much like a commitment to a fast.
That's right, and that's a kind of irrevocable commitment. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you'll note is that that's a nonviolent irrevocable commitment.
I'm having trouble putting this into a context of our normal activities, though. In a business or personal situation, a church situation, can you give an example?
I write engineering reports on my team of engineers. I'm in a pleasant situation of having these people wanting to do better work than I can afford. So I always say, give me your work now. I need to put it in the report. And they'll say, no, I need another 2 weeks. I just need to work with this data a little bit more. And I'll say, I'm publishing the report. It's going to the printers tomorrow morning. If I don't have your stuff, it just won't be in there. No problem. But you're going to get comments from everybody, and you're going to spend hours and hours of your time having to answer questions about this data because it's not presented in the report. It's going to the printer. I have an appointment with the printer, and I have to meet it, and that's the way it is. And then they're forced to give me their data. It's not as good as they want, but it's usually pretty damn good. You know, you just that I know that it's good. I know that it's done. They can't let go. So you just say,
does that
it's your choice now.
Does that help? So they don't have to be these life or death things. They can simply be very, you know, very simple things like, I am going to the movies.
Deadlines.
Yeah. Particularly, well, we'll get to some of these things.
Can I ask a quick question on
sure.
the threats? Is the difference between a threat and irrevocable? Is a threat within your heart and you know you're not going to carry it out? And the irrevocable
well, a threat
is
a thing that you a threat is a thing you hope not to carry out. Mm. An irrevocable commitment is a thing that you do.
A threat is conditional.
That's right. A threat is conditional. If you continue doing this, I will do this. Whereas an irrevocable commitment is, look, I have already called the printer. And they're expecting it. So it's not like you can say, I'll not print it if you act nice. You've made a commitment. So that's the difference. Is a threat is something actually you'd prefer not to do, whereas an irrevocable commitment is a thing you have decided you will do.
This description of threats sounded to me more like warnings. Is there a difference between a warning and a threat?
No, I don't think so. But
like
yes, there is a difference between a warning and a threat. You think it's a warning, they think it's a threat. Again, another virtue of irrevocable commitments is if they work, then the consequence, the bad thing that might happen is avoided. One of the real problems with irrevocable commitments is this issue of communication that I was talking about earlier. That is, there's there are a whole bunch of ways that communication can go awry with an irrevocable commitment. That is, the other party may not really understand the cost that they'll have to pay given your irrevocable commitment. It could be that the government in India said, well, who cares if Gandhi dies?
Yay!
Yeah, yay, he's gone! So, and they might not understand that there might then be a popular uprising. So that if you do an irrevocable commitment, you can't just say, well, I just don't need. Because what you have to do is to say, I won't eat, and if I die, there'll be a lot of people who won't be happy. And you'll have to deal with that situation. So you need to be very clear to the other party about what the costs are if they don't do something based on your irrevocable commitment, which is the kind of thing you were doing as you described to them, to your engineers, the trouble that they'd be put through, because they could have said, well, go ahead, print it. I don't care. simply because they don't understand the cost. It's possible that the other party might not have it within their power to make the concession. You might misunderstand the engineer and think that they actually do have good enough data, when in fact, they hardly have any data at all. And if you then make an irrevocable commitment, well, then you're on a train wreck. So you have to be careful when you make irrevocable commitments that you understand precisely where the other party is.
And that you can live with the consequences if they don't come through.
That's right. And that you can live with it if they don't come through. And one of the problems, in fact, is that you might misjudge the value of the various outcomes to the other person. That is, the other person might prefer a train wreck.
Could we say that a irrevocable commitment is a threat in action?
That's right. It's a threat that you carry out immediately.
If it's already in progress.
That's right. You say, here it is, you've now got to do something because I have set the wheels in motion. One of the good things to do with these kinds of irrevocable commitments is to do them publicly, which is part of what your printer example does, is that because there are a variety of people who then know that the report is coming out and who are expecting. This convinces the person, by the way, that it's likely to happen. So that you don't have the problem. It also makes the other person or the other party think very carefully then about what the consequences may be. So you get to avoid some of these miscommunication issues if you do these publicly rather than privately. Of course, the problem, if you do them publicly, is that they're really irrevocable. So you might get yourself into more trouble.
During the time you sound to the tree, the dam probably has a little value unless the media knows it.
Unless the media knows about it, unless it's a well-known person. What you have to do is, you know, these people may have tied themselves to the trees or to the rocks in the floodplain. And our company could have said, well, good, we'll be rid of them then.
Well, actually, they'd find some satellite imagery, find out where they are, going to rest of the trespassing. You know?
That's right. Yeah, so you need to be, so irrevocable commitments. Let me give you an example of one that I was involved in. Again, it was nonviolent. We were trying to convince the College of William and Mary to get asbestos out of the buildings, and they were. We thought they were being a lot more slow in doing it than they ought to be. So first we got their attention, convinced them that we knew what we were doing by one day bringing in the news media and having them film all the classes in a particular building with everyone wearing little gas dust masks. This convinced that we were organized enough to do something. And it got on the nightly news and that sort of stuff. Then what we did, when it was clear that nothing was going to happen, is we began organizing a campaign to have students drive down to Newport News together and sell their blood plasma. And take that money, put it in a pool, and donate it publicly to the college to help with the removal of asbestos, which they found particularly embarrassing. The students were selling their blood in order to help get asbestos removed from the building.
Are you available for hire?
fact, action was taken fairly quickly at that point. Because they figured that that was the kind of headline that would get out on the UPI wire and might go all over the country. We made it look like an irrevocable commitment. In fact, it wasn't. We didn't go sell our blood. But part of what convinced them was that they knew that we could organize and get something done in the past. Or we had done that, yes.
Supposing you wanted to do something that you wanted to be right, you didn't want to just get your way.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, you see, that can be true in all of these.
But if you use the media, aren't you putting the other person in a position to have to do something that they may not agree with? I mean, for instance, I've heard that getting rid of asbestos is really, that was a scare that didn't mm-hmm. need to be done, and that the asbestos, certain asbestos, was not that bad. And so
that's right.
So you believed in what you were doing, but I don't think you probably wanted to be wrong. So as soon as you brought the media in and you did these things, you forced the college, most likely, to move, and they started having no choice.
That's right, they had very little choice. And I could have been wrong. I mean, this is the problem we have in all of our relationships with, you know, any organization or other people. It's possible that you're wrong, and you have to think carefully about what you're going to do.
Also, it went out of a discussion and looking at facts and deciding what was best.
Yeah, but we were not convinced that the administration was really interested in a discussion. And see, and that's why, and we felt that we were in this situation where we needed to escalate in order to get their attention. And that's the kind of situation that really I'm talking about today. There are, and we had organized and tried to talk to them, and tried to work out schedules, et cetera, and nothing had happened. See, one of the real strategies that people in power have that those in power lose, precisely because they don't have power, is inaction. If the people who are in power have things the way they want, well, they simply have to do nothing in order to get their way. Whereas the people who are out of power have to force movement in order to get something. Did that make sense? And you see big organizations using this all the time. And it's precisely these kinds of... Let me recommend a book to you. It's by, let me write his name down because you may, you probably won't pronounce it well enough. So it's by a well-known organizer whose name is Saul Alinsky. A-L-I-N-S-K-Y. And the title of the book is Rules for Radicals. The point of Alinsky was very well known in Chicago as an organizer among the poor. And he was able in creative ways. In fact, he wasn't quite for hire, but he was willing to go all around the country and help people organize. He was able to creatively use the power that powerless people had in order to escalate. So his business was escalation in order to get the other party to come to the table and negotiate. He wasn't interested simply in winning, but he was interested in getting a negotiated outcome, and you have to escalate with some parties in order to get to the table to talk. Because powerful interests can simply not do something, and they win if they don't do anything. So those are all the strategies that I was talking about. I want to do quickly one more thing, and then we can have sort of free discussion. That is, I want to talk about what happens after you start this threat and counter-threat sequence. One of the transformations that occurs in the dollar auction game occurs around 45 to 60 cents. And what you find is that around 45 to 60 cents, it usually usually you have a large number of bidders and it drops down to two or three. Because people then begin to see the problem that they're caught in. And they no longer want to be caught as the second highest bidder. We didn't get to the point that we often get to in the dollar auction game with regard to this third transformation. The first part of the dollar auction game, you're interested simply in getting a dollar for cheap. That's very possible to do. So you're interested in doing well. In the second part of the dollar auction game that we got into, which is after, say, 60 cents, and you have just two bidders, people get interested in winning. The two folks who are left are interested in winning, or at least in not losing. The third part of the dollar auction game that I get into every once in a while, and that's when I can make lots of money, is when they're interested and making the other person look as silly as possible. And if you get two sides that are both interested in doing that, they're willing to take some risk in order to make the other person have to buy a dollar for $2.50. Pay money, not get anything. This kind of transformation happens often whenever you get into any escalation sequence. That's why it's dangerous to escalate. It's at times both important and dangerous to escalate, if that makes sense. You have to do it in order to get the other person's attention, but it's very dangerous because you can get trapped based on all the kind of misperceptions we've been talking this week into this rising spiral of conflict. It's also true in conflicts that the tactics often run from light to heavy. We talked about that before. First just small threats, later larger threats, big irrevocable commitments. You often find also that the goals may start out specific. That is, we want to make sure that South Vietnam can survive as a country. And they then get general after a lot of escalation, where you begin to say, we want to stop communism all over the world. And this is just one place. One of the things that you'll find in family fights, even, is that you may start with where the scissors are. And you may end up with why they've always hated you. And that's this move that we're talking about. And if you see that happening to yourself, you can say, aha, I know what's going on now. I'm in this spiral of conflict. Another kind of transformation that occurs during escalation is that from few to many, and that's with issues and people. That is, the conflict may just be between two people, but as it becomes more important, as you get angrier, you get your relatives in, you bring your friends and colleagues in, you get other people involved, so that the escalation turns into a family feud. As we're talking now, I'm just talking about families, but you can do this in organizations too. You can do it in government also. In terms of the number of issues, you also get this kind of explosion. So that now it's no longer just. This happened a lot in the protests in the 60s in universities, and that is that the student committees would get together and they would demand something, a pop machine, you know. And if it didn't happen, then they'd get upset. And they'd begin, within their group, rehearsing all the bad things the administration had ever done, and they'd come up with a list of 30 things the administration had to do next. And you will find this in conflicts that happen in your church, too, is that it may start over one issue, but it will explode into a whole bunch of different issues.
During the 70s and 60s, there were great many campus uprisings. They had one at the University of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It was started over head bolt heaters.
Head bolt heaters?
Head bolt heaters. Talk about a minor issue. Faculty had a place to plug in those little heaters that kept their engine warm, so the cars.
Oh, and students did not.
Students did not.
And this was a gross injustice.
And it turned into a riot.
Well, in Alaska, it might be a gross injustice. But then it turned. But once it started escalating, they brought in a bunch more issues,
right,
in order, to some extent, to justify the fact that they were really so angry.
Right.
So you can find escalation, take it off like that. Yeah, that's a great example. I'll use that example in Minnesota. Folks will understand it. So I'm sorry I spent so much time laying out all this stuff, but I did have this week a lot of people asking me questions about, well, what do you do when you get into these situations? And I figured I would, let me suggest this book to you. I asked the bookstore to order it, and they did not have enough time to get it. You can come up and write all the authors down, etc. But it's called Social Conflict, Escalation, Stalemate, and Settlement. I steal a lot of my ideas from here. It's slightly academic, but in fact it's written in a sort of handbook fashion. And that's like these lists of things. I talk about threats. Here's advantages and disadvantages of threats. They do a very good job in the book of laying all that kind of stuff out. And then they connect it to all of the research that the psychologists have done, so that you know that you can trust the kind of advice that you're getting instead of someone simply talking through their hat. So I highly recommend this book. I know this has been a whole bunch of stuff to dump on you. Any thoughts? Yes.
So I can see a situation where, and I'm going to go to our church, and being a member of the church council.
Don't tell them I said so.
Or where I heard it. I can see situations where there might be a small issue that we are talking about,
mm-hmm,
that could escalate into something where you have other people becoming involved, telling other people of the church, getting their friends in.
Getting more issues in.
Yeah, the thing just mushrooms into, right, a big thing that's going to be bad for everybody.
And then you have two churches.
Yeah. The best thing to do is just keep it to that one small original problem that we're having to try to solve that first. Rather than let it get to that point.
Sometimes. Yeah. It depends.
Because sometimes they bring in all this other stuff because this is just a small symptom of a larger problem. You really have to get that other problem out in the open. before you can talk about the real problem. It's not an issue of where we store the toilet paper so that people can get at it if they need it. It's an issue of some people control all the resources. And we really need to talk about this control of resources rather than where you store the toilet paper.
And in fact, thank you for that advertisement. I'll be doing that tomorrow. Is talking about how we work on finding out what some of the basic or fundamental underlying issues are in a conflict. Because very often, it can be a small thing. So it's not always true that it's good to limit it. In fact, usually what it's good to do is to try to find the fundamental issues. It is not always good to do that either, because it may be that you disagree horribly on the fundamental issues and will never agree, and you just want some toilet paper. So it might be better, and see, this is where it simply takes careful thought informed by an ability to think out all of the possible consequences in a situation like this. And what so often happens in these conflicts is people get upset and then they immediately fall into condemning the other person and making threats instead of saying, well, what would the best thing be to do? So the question you asked is precisely the place to start. And I have again avoided giving you an answer. For which I do not apologize. Yes?
One management consultant, to avoid this problem of scattershot where somebody brings up an issue and another side just wants to throw the kitchen sink and everything else.
Right.
He'll take an ashtray or something in the middle of the table and say, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the people, we're talking about past history or future, but this is the issue. Let's concentrate on this issue.
Right.
And he'll point at that, and if somebody starts getting off on tangents, he'll get back to the
It's easy simply just to point at that. Yeah. And if you've decided that the best thing to do is to concentrate on the issue, that's a good idea. Because one of the things it allows you is some nonverbal sorts of things in the negotiation or in the conflict, rather than having to say to them, well, you're off the point now, Fred. You can just sort of say, see the ashtray? Well, but you see,
this is escalating.
Part of what you have to do then is to agree that you'll only discuss that one issue. And that's a hard thing to get done, is to get both sides to agree that they're going to stay with just that issue. Otherwise, they will perceive your ashtray as a manipulative ploy and throw it out the window. There are easy answers to this.
There are or there aren't?
Are not.
Are not.
I can promise there are not. There just aren't easy answers to this. It requires a whole lot of patience and a whole lot of careful thought. And a lot of what I'm doing is simply providing you with tools to do some of this careful thought. Ways to get started when you want to think carefully about it. Because it's really you who've got to do the thinking. A book isn't going to tell you what your motivations are. But it will tell you to think about your motivations and give you perhaps some tools for doing it. Well, we are out of time. Thank you very much. And the answers are tomorrow.
Well, yes, sir.